Greetings, range seekers, and welcome back to the Bendability Podcast with me, Emmett Lewis, the Splits Wizard. In this week's episode, we are going to be doing a comprehensive review of the book Stretching Scientifically by Thomas Kurz. But before we get on to that, just a bit of housekeeping, I suppose. First off, just a shout out to my South Korean listeners for the launch of the podcast. We have been charted number one in the fitness category in South Korea. So whoever you are in South Korea, thanks so much for listening in and, you know, give me a nudge wherever you are. Other than that, thanks everyone else who has been listening. We've been charting super high just from the launch. So thank you all for that. I'm really happy that people find it. You know, remember, like, subscribe, all that. If people are looking for Apple, we're a bit behind there for some reason. Their moderation system is a bit slow, but it's coming. But other than that, let's get on to it. So Stretching Scientifically is in its fourth edition, and we'll cut to the end of the review and commentary. You need this book in your library if you're interested in range of motion development and range of motion development training. Is it the be all and end all? No, I don't think any book covers every single facet of it, but it is definitely one of the ones. We have to look at it. It's been in publication since the 80s. It has sold 10 million copies, making it basically the twilight of the flexibility world. In fact, it's probably one of the twilight of some of the strength and conditioning books out there. So it is very good. There's also every other book by Thomas Kurz is also good. There's one, Planning for Peak Performance. That one is fantastic as well. It's definitely worth having in your library. So what we're going to do now is I'm actually going to read through it. I have my copy, which is the third edition, and some of the pages are falling out. I have it annotated, and I want to read through some of the things and give some of the commentary and some of the placement of it. And it kind of begins to, it will put a lot of stuff into context as I see it. And that's why this was probably going to be a two-part review, more so than anything else, because I got about halfway through annotating it and going, realizing there's a lot to do. So I'm going to do the start of the book, and then I will do all the exercise and commentary on that in the next part of the review, which will be later in the season. So first off, the book itself, paperbound, it's impressive. It's basically got this good thing of social proofing, where the first is like, do you want the Van Damme split? You got to remember, at the time when this book was first published, Jean-Claude Van Damme was the man. He still is the man, but he was the man. And he was doing splits all over the place. And there was all these rumors going around, which I still hear repeated today, that Jean-Claude Van Damme could do all those splits because he had the tendons and the ligaments cut in his hip, but no one else could do it. There was kind of this rumor going around. I'm sure some of you who are a bit older have heard it. And then out comes Thomas Kurz with his book going, look, I can do this shit. There you go. Do you want to learn how to do it? Bam. I'd buy it. I did buy it. But that's the kind of context of it. And obviously, martial arts in the 80s, 70s and 80s, martial arts was like kind of dojo martial arts. Obviously, it's got a big resurgence, but like dojo martial arts, karate, taekwondo and stuff were on this massive up peak of just like it was, you know, that kind of era, like Chuck Norris, Bruce Lee, obviously, all this kind of thing, where it kind of died off and now it's coming back, obviously, with the rise of MMA and other stuff. But it was that era when like martial arts stars were some of the biggest movie stars of the time. And seeing this and feeding into this and going, look, I can give you the skills of this person you aspire to, was a win and go. And obviously, Thomas Kurz does deliver. So on the inside of the front cover, we have the testimonials. Once again, we have this idea of social proofing. Social proofing is when you see results by people like you. This is in the fitness context, is a bigger, broader social thing. But the social proofing goes like, oh, there is people like me doing the thing I want to do, and they use this method to get it. Oh, that instantly will boost confidence and adherence in a program. And as we know, confidence, adherence, and compliance to a program and consistency over time is what will get you a large percent of your results. Confidence will get a huge amount of results. Adherence, obviously, more. So being able to give someone an idea of like, oh, here's some guys in their gis, here's some guys in their martial arts outfits. Oh, here's a black belt, here's the thing. Oh shit, I'm a brown belt and I haven't got splits yet. But by the time I'm a black belt, I can have splits on the chair like this guy. Bam, sold. It's not just, it's not just a one-off method. And this is obviously what I like about it as well. It's not just someone who is flexible going like, you too can be flexible by myself, just like me. But at the same time, it's not a big a buy-in. And there is always a bit of a buy-in on these type of things where you see, oh, I like this coach who doesn't really have any students, just puts things out, because I can see myself in them doing the things they do. And that's what gives me the buy-in. It's part of the, what I term the three P's of fitness sales. Personality, progress, and process. I'm not really going to talk about business, but, you know, buy my business. I don't even have a business course, but I probably should. But we'll talk about them some other time. We're going to stick with Mr. Kurz. So Thomas Kurz, Mr. Kurz, or Granddaddy Kurz, as I like to call him, is, you know, the book is amazing. It gives you a lot and gives you a lot of precise things. It has its flaws, as we'll get through, but I wanted to start. So, interesting thing about the author. Before coming to the USA, Thomas Kurz studied physical education in one of the top Eastern European institutions that prepare coaches, instructors, teachers of physical education and rehabilitation specialists. He studied for 5 years at, I'm not going to try and pronounce the Polish one, but it's the Academy of Physical Education in Warsaw. While still a student, he was appointed head coach of the judo team, a versatile athlete. Thomas Kurz competed in several Olympic sports, including swimming, gymnastics, and track and field events. This is where things get interesting, actually, for me, is he's presenting a method as the most advanced thing at the time, but he was competing in gymnastics and obviously martial arts as well. Did he use these methods to get flexible? Did he use them precisely or did he use something inferior and get the results or get them at a younger age and maintain them? It's something you do have to be wary of. Or was he, this is the thing with the Eastern European system, I'm going to talk a bit about that, is there's a lot of selection to the people who have the right traits from an early age to do things. So someone who is more flexible and more predisposed to it, even looking at parents. I can even remember one of my clients in the early days of training. She came to me and she wanted to learn gymnastics. Story time as usual. And she wanted to do rhythmic gymnastics as she was a kid. And she went to a rhythmic gymnastics club with her parents. And they took one look at the mother and said no, based on how the mother appeared. And she was like, no. And like, you know, she had a build that wouldn't have been the top tier rhythmic gymnastics build. And they, you know, but she was basically just denied access to the sport, even at a hobby level, because it just would not make it. So we have to bear this in mind. Other than that, you know, if he was flexible, it's kind of the thing, like I said myself, I got flexible using methods I would not promote. They definitely worked, but I find there's much more efficient things. And it's this kind of thing that now I know that there's a better way, and maybe Thomas Kurz learns there's a better way, or maybe they were using these methods when he was younger. It's just an interesting thing to think about. So we have a preface, and there's something interesting in the preface I want to go. There's two interesting points here. If you have read only the books and research papers on flexibility that were published in the West, you will notice that I sometimes use different terms in writing about this subject. Other times, familiar terms may denote something different than the meaning you're used to. See, this is the kind of interesting thing. There is a lot of arguments about semantics and what things mean. And you see this on the flexibility discourse, you see it on strength training discourse, you see it in mobility, flexibility, all these kind of interchangeable terms. There is, in physics and chemistry, there's IUPAC, which is the International Union of Physics and Applied Chemistry. And they decide the how you name things, how things go, and how terms are defined. In flexibility training and strength training, we don't have such a body. And while there is definitions in textbooks, things do change around and language evolves. So there is this argument that, like, when some people is talking, you do have to understand, like, what are they saying? What do they mean by this term? You encounter this a lot in sports, you encounter other stuff. It's like, say, I think there's a passage in Super Training by Dr. Mel Siff, where he talks about, like, flexible, using the term someone is flexible is kind of a bit useless, because flexibility is context specific, and doing the splits doesn't necessarily mean you are flexible in other ranges of motion. It's, I think he uses the example of, like, people who can do the splits, it's very difficult sometimes for them to do a full deep squat. And it's like, oh, well, flexibility, as we know, can vary over joints. Someone could have, like, amazing leg flexibility and not be able to get their arms fully overhead. So to say someone is flexible, there is a context to these things, and we have to bear that in mind. And there is a context to the usage of language. And while there's no clear definitions, there is definitions, but the definitions we might use in the West and in the Western system might not be the same that they would use in the Chinese system, in different disciplines that even in the West, like supple, flexible, all these kind of things, loose, tight. You know, there is a meaning of these things, but the translation of the meaning and the other stuff doesn't actually translate across or hasn't diffused across. So just bear that in mind as we go through this, and bear that in mind when you're reading things online. There's one passage here I want to just talk about it briefly, or long as well. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the term East Bloc is rapidly assuming a status of quaint antiquity. It was used to refer to the nations of Eastern Europe that had been unwillingly absorbed by the USSR. For decades, these nations, especially Poland, East Germany, Hungary, and Romania, dominated the Olympics and other international athletics contests far beyond what one might expect based on size and resources. The difference lay in their common use of advanced methods of training. Do they have advanced methods? Yes. Do we actually know the context that there was a whole government apparatus and meat grinder going on to, one, systematically enable the use of doping, either through advanced testing, doping athletes without their consent or informed, and also making things such as oral turanabol and other things as part of a coordinated state plan to defeat the Olympic drug testing thing at the time to get the results? We know this to be true. You can read about it, doping in East Germany, on Wikipedia has a very good article on this. We know there was a massive drug usage in this going in. Obviously the methods help, and obviously I'm not saying other countries didn't dope, but we know with these Eastern European nations that there was a huge state apparatus, and it's very different than an athlete, what we find nowadays, say in USA or even over here in Ireland, I won't name some names, but we know people order their shit on the internet and try and blag their drug tests by themselves and figure it out. There's not a government thing involving the Stasi. Everything from scientists creating this stuff, research impurity, analyzing, testing people, providing it based on thing with the compliance of the coaches, the governing bodies, and everything. So to say it was down to completely down to that, yes, no. To say to deny the usage of drugs in their success is wrong. So it's just something just to bear in mind on that, that's kind of jumped out at me. We also have to remember with these Eastern Bloc countries, sporting and proving the superiority of their system. Sporting was one of the ways they proved the superiority of their system. Being able to be top of the sports with limited resources. You see this even in small nations when they just go all in on one sport. We see it with Jamaica and sprinting, where they go all in and sprinting is the thing. We see it in Ireland with our GAA, which is the Gaelic Athletic Association, which is our national sports. We see it in there where all our really good athletes get hoovered up in this direction, and we may not be as good in soccer or other stuff. But then you see it in rugby. We're a small country, but we're doing really well in rugby because there's so much directed towards it. So you see this in these kind of, I've seen this in the Chinese system intimately because I'm familiar with it quite from circus, where there is this filtration system where they literally start screening kids in China from like a certain age based on anthropomorphy and anthropomorphy of the parents. Once again, back to my Russian example of going hand and foot size and relative length of femurs. And we also have all these kind of things where they go, oh, you'll be really good at these sports. So you'll play these three sports and everything you do will be geared towards making you good at this. So for every champion you would see in this, there might be 400, 500, 600, 700 people who were put in the meat grinder and did not survive. So when you're filtering for the people who have the physiques that are inherently biased towards something from a population group, and then everything they do at the neglect of their education and social lives and everything is geared towards this kind of direction, you do end up with some very good people. Throw in some training, state schools generally, and these kind of things, people get good. And it's kind of like you see this in the gymnastics schools in China, where they have gymnastics schools where kids will go and they will be filtered, selected, and kind of given all the training, everything the training. The training in China is generally pretty good. They know what they're doing, they're a bit brutal, but you know, you can't deny it works. And they're meant to be doing their studies and their academic work as well. But most of the time, the kids are so tired from the training, they just fall asleep in their lessons, the teachers just kind of teach rote at the front and just kind of ignore it because they know the kids are wrecked. And then by the end of it, if they wash out or if they make it in the program, they do or do not, and then they don't have an academic basis. So do that. I know there are sports academies in the West, but they're still not as selective in that. So just bear that in mind when we read that. And RDs, it's always that kind of thing we get in fitness. It's died down a lot, but it was like these secret Soviet methods, the Bulgarian method, the Ukrainian method, all these secret Soviet methods, because it's kind of mystique and, you know, let's you know, blame Pavel for it is. Had a request to review super joints, which I will do as well. Anyway, onto the content of the book. So you most likely already know what flexibility is and what advantages are to having it developed to a high level. It is one of the essential motor qualities of an athlete. I would argue it is one of the most essential motor qualities involved. It is one of the most fundamental ones. We have coordination, strength, and flexibility, range of motion. Obviously, once again, going back to our male sif at the start, do we really know what flexibility is, or is it a, you know, yeah, basically, do we know what it is, or do we have a weird definition of it? Some motor qualities are inborn, such as speed. Others, such as balance, have to develop at an early age. Flexibility is like strength and endurance, however, in that it can be brought to high level by anyone and at any time in one's life. Outside of pathological cases, there is no such thing as inborn flexibility. We can argue this. There is like a lot of gender-based differences and sex hormone differences, and also favorable and unfavorable joint geometries that will allow people to express greater and smaller ranges of motion, as well as different fiber types and different collagen types. So I wouldn't say call it a pathological, but there is people out there who get flexible much easier, and there is people who display a greater range of motion without ever training. We do have to bear this in mind because there is context to all our training. But I know I'm being pedantic, but I do think it's worth stating. You can improve flexibility by doing exercises such as running, swimming, and weightlifting as long as your limbs go through the full range of motion. Not all athletes can always lift weights or run middle or long distance, though. At some stage in training, these exercises can interfere with the development of a special form. Properly chosen stretching exercises, this is the key point, are less time and energy consuming than these indirect methods. Now, obviously, lately there's kind of this argument, you see it online, that just the comparison of strength training through full range of motion and flexibility methods has been made, and the meta-analyses conclude that they are just as effective. I'm going to cover that actual whole meta-analysis as a separate episode, but it's one of these things that it's very time efficient to select the methods that will give you the greatest bang for your buck and focus on that. This is what we do with flexibility training. This is what we do with selecting strength training over bodybuilding methods, over endurance methods, depending on the outcome and the adaptation we want in the person or the organism. We choose the methods based on that and we go in one direction. This is the crux of what we do as coaches. We have to be selective and saying, oh yes, I will be able to squat full range of motion, and if I squat full range of motion long enough, I will get a lovely ass to grass squat. Maybe, maybe not. You know, as we've seen for a lot of people, that isn't the situation. They need to add some supplementary range of motion training, and they probably would have got their ass to grass squat much faster if they added the range of motion development training and done the strength training at the same time, and then brought these two motor abilities up. And then by the time they've gathered the range of motion, their strength would have risen at the same thing, rather than suddenly being able to go 10 centimeters deeper into your squat and not having the strength to match your three-quarter squat at that stage. So just bear that in mind. So the next kind of chapter on the theory, it gives a good overview of the theory, actin, myosin, all these kind of things, muscle architecture, all these kind of things in a general movement. It's like an entry-level textbook. That's what I kind of like about it. It's reductive, it's not in-depth, but it's perfect for what you need is if you don't want to get into the full biology of the system on the full biomechanics. You just need to get an understanding of the terms, the definitions, and understand how they apply. And it's a very good overview, it's a very good thing. We could argue that some of it isn't up-to-date and needs a bit of updating. But, you know, it's a good overview. It's like a first year textbook in university. That would be the way I describe it. There's some other ones that are more advanced, but we'll get there. Here we go. It's one of these things people don't really understand. Muscle contracts with the greatest force at its normal resting length. Okay, fine. Whole muscle is encased in a fibrous connective tissue sheet, the epimysium. Bundles and even single cells are also surrounded by the same tissue. And tension generated by muscle cells is transferred to the fibers of the connective tissue. One of these points that I want to make is, like, a lot of people just don't understand that connective tissue is continuous and muscle fibers are discrete. What this means is they are generally placed dotted along in different densities, different placements. And the connective tissue is basically what forms this whole fascial connection. And there's layers to it as well. And this is one of these things that we can think it goes deeper, deeper, deeper. And the whole fascia of the body penetrates through everything, or the collagen matrix of the body, more correctly, I suppose. It goes all the way through the bones, it goes through the organs. It's what makes you whole. People think muscles, like, it has the muscle fibers run in length. They don't. And this is why one of these things, we can add sarcomeres in series, so muscle fibers in series, by using flexibility and eccentric based training. But it doesn't change the length of the muscle per se. It doesn't literally grow, if I measure from origin to insertion. It doesn't grow that length. It doesn't make my arms longer. And this is one of these things just to bear in mind. We probably could, if we applied enough force at a longer distance past the elongation threshold of the muscle fibers, but that's a thing for the torture rack. But it is just one of these things to bear in mind, that we are dealing with other stuff. Now, my book at this point is Falling Apart. This is kind of one of the more interesting ones. That's kind of, doesn't really get touched on, but it's definitely something I've experienced both through my own training and through the training I'm currently doing in the internal martial arts and Neigong and all these kind of things. Bone is a dynamic living tissue made of crystals, calcium and phosphorus, blah, blah, blah. The forms of joint surfaces covered by a glass-like smooth elastic cartilage also changes in the long-term process of exercise. This is one of the more interesting adaptations, something I've experienced directly through my own training and also in the current practice I do in training Neigong, where you're literally trying to change the bones. There's a lot of, like, things we do, bone squeezing, sounds weird, and packing and density. You're putting your intent into using this kind of surface and applying force to it to make it adapt. And that in turn allows the muscles and whatever else. The sensation you get is that things move smoother and glide, and there's more fluidity to the body. And I mean that in terms of it feels like your body is beginning to be coated in. Imagine if you filled a wetsuit, like a neoprene wetsuit, with water bags, and you then beat someone with that. That's the feeling you get with these kind of strikes. And this is what one of the things that gives the internal striking, the ability to penetrate at very low speeds and cause a lot of damage. And it's very interesting, the training to it. And it relies on this kind of idea of train for a long time, train very gently, but you're doing a lot of dynamic motions that is specifically designed to put everything under a stretch and release it, stretch and release. And this kind of stretch and release and the ability to generate stretch is also begins to teach you how to generate a stretch in very quick amount of time to release. So instead of doing a big pullback, you can kind of stretch, release. So just kind of something to be noted there. Yeah, my pages are falling out of my book because it's so red. There's an interesting one here. So I'm not going to read every single thing on this, obviously. I'm just going to give you guys just some commentary on the stuff for when you're reading. The knee-jerk reflex is an example of a myotactic or stretch reflex. This is a great one that you see it in Charles Poliquin talked about the stretch reflex squats is one of the programs, myotactic. And then a lot of people were basically not knowing what he meant and started using that word as a myotactic squats, myotactic, blah. And you're like, well, what are you doing? It's basically you're making a stretch. You're making a rapid stretch of the tendons to cause everything to flinch and to go out. So it's kind of, I know some people say, oh, of course we understood that. I see this copy pasted from a lot of people who, let's face it, call it as it is. It was in an Edo program. And then a lot of people who are movement coaches and other stuff, let's face it, just copy-pasted EDOS program. I know, I have a lot of these clients who come along and then they show me the program they got, and it's the exact same one, spelling mistakes and everything, from someone who also got it from Edo or got it from one of his students, whatever. Blah. So it's kind of just, it's a funny offhand comment more so than anything else. And if you are copy-pasting a program you got off someone else and applying it to someone who isn't the case thing, it's probably not the best idea, and you should probably try and tailor things a bit more to them. And, you know, that said, congratulations to Edo for making probably one of the most successful programs going on the thing, and the most copy-pasted program I've ever seen. So, you know, credit where credit is due. Oh, I lost one. So there's kind of one of the things to cover in this is the type of stretch receptors and what their roles are. We know that there is, well, hopefully you know, that there's ones that govern position, elongation, and speed and elongation. And these ones will dictate body position and other stuff. There's one type he touches on that I want to touch on a bit more is the Ruffini endings. Slowly adapting receptors that are scattered through the joint capsule and sense the position of the joint. The Ruffini endings are kind of interesting because I use them a lot in some of the training we do, where anyone who's come to my seminar will know the very first thing we do in the icebreaker is we play around with this and we do some ankle distraction to open and close the joint. So it's kind of, and this allows the body to express or repress ranges of motion. And it's kind of fun because it's kind of very quickly you can get some very good Instagram shots and show it. It's obviously a transient effect, it's an acute effect like anything else, but also shows that our body position is related to our joint position, and the joints going into position force the muscles to react. So if you're always forward on your toes or always backwards or leaning on one side, it kind of sets up the musculoskeletal chain to begin to react in one direction, anticipate what is going on. So these kind of things will play that known, like, there's no real such thing as neutral, but if we had a concept of postural neutral, it would have the minimum amount of activation of the muscles, other than the muscles involved in the anti-gravity mechanisms, which we'll get to in a bit. And this would allow the greatest freedom of motion. But obviously, because we have habitual patterns, things we train more than others, and just the way we sit, move, and everything in modern life, we can't really ever find the true neutral. But it's these Ruffini receptors are what give the feedback that the body is kind of locked in one position or ready to move in one position. This becomes very important in some of the stuff that we're going to talk about later in the series when we start talking about how stretching changes the way we think, and also the sort of psychological emergence I mentioned in the first kind of episode. So one of the things he talks about in this kind of section is talking about how for most people it is the nervous system tension is what regulates your flexibility. And it's kind of one of those things, like, it's to say that this is what regulates it, yes and no. I remember, obviously, I believe this, like, oh, the adductors, nothing crosses the middle, so everyone should be able to do a middle split. And I actually had a chat with a surgeon who specializes in pelvic surgeries at one point in his career. And this is what he do. And he was talking about pelvic surgeries and all these kind of things. And I was asking him, like, oh, it must be so cool that, you know, you can just put someone into a split and get right in there. And he's like, that's not the situation. It doesn't work like that. And it's kind of one of these things that people are more flexible, and they always use the frozen shoulder example, like the body is clamped down because of some kind of pain or some kind of how to describe it, something has disturbed the body and made it not want to express range of motion, basically. But anyway, the surgeon today clarified to me that when people are under general anesthetic, they still have two surgical interns reefing their legs apart for him to actually get in there, and, you know, using stirrups and everything. And a lot of times, like, people, he's saying, are so locked down that, you know, for him to get in, and they might not be able to even get 90 degrees of adduction on the transverse plane, that you know, they're pulling totally tightly, and the people can end up with, like, low-grade tears in their adductors and adductor magnus and shit just from being pulled apart enough to actually allow the guy to get in there and the surgical team to get in and do the surgery. It's one of the iatrogenic things they have to consider. It's like, what will the effect be if we take this person, like, oh, it's a young, healthy person that would recover as part of the thing. Oh, it's an older 80-year-old who needs some kind of thing. Oh, iatrogenic step in there. So when you hear this kind of myth that people say, oh, we put young under anesthetic and they're full flexibility, it's not actually the case. And we know even if we do static passive stretching, that there is muscle architecture changes that are detectable after a couple of weeks of doing this, even for low duration stretches. So it is quite easy to imagine that if we are going to pursue this path of strength-based flexibility training, then there will be muscle architecture training. There will be hypertrophy, there will be linear hypertrophy, radial hypertrophy, there will be collagen laid down, there will be collagen fiber alignment, there'll be change in pination angle, all these kind of things. So it is one of these myths. Everyone is super flexible under thing. I don't buy it. I'm willing to be proven wrong if someone wants to put me under general anesthesia and we can make me sit on my own head, contortion style. The other argument I heard of talking to the surgeon is that the general anesthesia and why people can display greater range of motion is they can go much further into the pain cave than you would ever want to go in without regulating. So people are more flexible because the thing that would tell them to stop, the pain regulation or the pain feedback system, it doesn't exist. So you can just be forced and forced. So just bear that in mind. So this is one of the interesting ones. This is the problem partially with science. Science is very reductive and measurist. And this kind of things, that things get mentioned offhand because they can't measure them or they haven't found a specific way to measure them. And this is it. The connection between the cerebellum and the areas of the brain governing emotion, the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the septal areas, make muscular tonus and coordination dependent on emotions and vice versa. So when I talk about psychological emergence and all these kind of weird things that can happen, there is this thing, it gets mentioned offhand in this book, but there's nothing really the way to train it, that there can be patterns that will make people open, there can be emotions that will make people close down. We can think of like someone who's chronically angry. What do we think? They carry this tension, they carry this forward head carriage and lurching, and their jaws may be tight and other kind of stuff. I'm going to talk much more in depth on this, but just to give you an idea, like, oh, someone angry, they get up, it flares them upwards, and all the things that are involved in going upward get turned on. And if they're chronically angry all the time, going around with this low-grade unexpressed anger or untalked about anger, then the body contraction will go like that, and it forms this feedback system where my physical tension feeds back into the brain to remind me of my anger. My anger reminds me, the physical body, to replicate the changes, and this is all mediated. So then you can see where I'm getting at, hopefully. But it's kind of funny that these are kind of mentioned, but then not really talked about. And there's one paragraph here. Yoga uses this connection. Yoga exercises, asanas do not use tension in a stretched position. I think a lot of yogis would disagree with that. By holding relaxed muscles in a position just short of pain and reflexive contractions, yogis in a long-term process gradually lower the sensitivity of the mechanisms regulating the tension in the lengthened muscles. Yoga stretches seem to be a litmus test or sort of biofeedback monitor, telling the practitioner how proper, from a yoga point of view, his or her state of mind is. That's kind of interesting, because if we're using it in biofeedback, we can also use it to express something or make something emerge. So we go, oh, I will put myself into a asana, a position. Why am I using asana? I'm not a yogi. I can put myself into a position that we know correlates with a psychological state, and we can generate this psychological state and we can make it emerge. We can think about this slightly in terms of, let's say someone was always scared of being hit. They're always scared of being slapped, and they always know whenever they're around some person, they have to go cower like this, and they're cowering and they're cowering. And this would build up a pattern of tension in the body, just like cycling on a bike would shorten the hamstrings. And we could argue yes or no, but just bear with me on this one. Shorten the hamstrings in a contracted position, they get really tight. It's the exact same thing. And then the tension pattern feeds into the mental state and vice versa. And we can use one to get rid of the other and the other to get rid of one. So, interesting stuff. Here is the crux of the thing that a lot of people don't seem to understand. Different stretching methods bring about differing results. Dynamic stretching improves dynamic flexibility. Static stretching improves static flexibility. And to a limited extent, dynamic flexibility. This is basically, this is basically the crux of it, is if we had methods that would improve them all, we kind of do actually. Observationally, through all the students I've worked with, ballistic stretching actually improves both at the same time, more so than one or the other. So just bear that in mind. But it is thing, like we have flexibility related to its speed, and we have open and closed chain, which will also go to this. Closed chain flexibility doesn't always correlate with open chain flexibility. It gives potential, but not the same. So it is this kind of thing of like, oh, I need to be flexible to do a static pose. Then we need to train statically. Oh, moving in and out of a position. Yes, that is definitely another one. But it means like when you're tailoring a program to yourself, you've got to choose your poison. And you also have to have an assessment system that goes like, actually, your reason you are limited in this range of motion is because of this, and that's how we fix it. Not just you must throw the kitchen sink at everything. So there's an interesting one here, actually talks about research done by Nicholas Brett in 1977, compares the effects of stretching in the supine and erect position. Greater gains were recorded for both groups in a supine test position than in an erect test position. The subjects tested in the erect position had to overcome an extra amount of tension in the muscles they stretched because of the reflexes evoked by standing and bending over. This is a kind of interesting one as well, because we have these. There's always a subconscious fear of the body falling over. It is a large amount of our movement when standing is based around correcting the posture and this inverted pendulum that we are. It's always kind of fluctuating. Our balance is always going and it's always working, detecting. It also means that there is all these muscles involved in maintaining the erect posture that are always basically on to a certain degree. And you've seen it when they get turned off, when someone gets knocked out, properly knocked out, not just like one of dazed and fall. They just kind of fall straight down because all the anti-gravity muscles were turned off. It's that same idea that if you're training in a standing position, that the apprehension, training in an unsupported position, this is where things get interesting, that these muscles can be turned off. In systems like stretch therapy or physical alchemy, they would use these kind of more supported positions using partners, partners, equipment, bolsters, cushioning to help turn off this reflective tension to allow the flexibility to be focused on solely on the exercises. This is one of the things that makes stretch therapy so effective, is you are so supported in a lot of positions. Positions are so stable. You do a lot of good quality work on the zone you want to focus in on without the interference of everything else. You can reduce all the tension and get an almost reset of the body's resting tension, because maybe your lower back is contracting much harder because you are scared of your lower back being injured than it needs to be to maintain an upright posture. And this is one of these things, like think of the person who's chronically tight or can't run or can't rotate. Possibly this is the reason they're so concerned with falling, or it's one, the nocebic effect of all the stuff we hear about the backs. One more mention of this, coordination and flexibility depend on your emotions too. Because the connection between the cerebellum and the areas of brain responsible for motion. Try juggling, balancing, and stretching when you're upset. Yeah, can't argue with that. Once again, it's the only mention of this, but it's so important. And no real thing, if you're talking about this as a manual for coaching, is like, how do we coach and how do we help people integrate what comes up in these positions if it does come up? Like, you have someone who ends up crying after stretching their splits or doing a calf stretch. How do you deal with that as a coach? It is a person's skill. One could be beneficial and one could be not beneficial. But it's this kind of pure reductionist biomechanical level of training when we know we're dealing with a human who has a whole cultural body, a personal body, a mental body, an abstract body of kind. I'm using these in very abstract terms that can be assisted in the coaching process to realize their true potential. So just bear in mind. The opening caution you read is worth repeating. Mental rigidity, the inability to abandon fixed ideas, is usually accompanied by low level of physical flexibility. You try tell a ballet dance teacher who is ultimately more flexible than you and I will ever be, that you shouldn't drink, that drinking water through ballet dance class in a warm room is probably a beneficial thing, and they will say, no, you can't drink water, or someone will go, and you try argue that. So I would say possibly this is an observational thing. It's not always. Patterns of tension in the body and patterns of tightness do accompany mental rigidity, because this is what we're doing. We're holding on to this idea of the self. But at the same time, you can't correlate, once again, going back to Mr. Sif, someone who's flexible doesn't necessarily in one joint and one range and in one trained kind of zone or multiple trained kind of zones isn't necessarily flexible, because there's no actual real definition of what a flexible person is versus an inflexible person. And it is also one of these things that a lot of people who display great range of motion and great things are sometimes, when we do the psychological emergence type stuff, the ones who suffer the most, because a lot of stuff comes out that was being held in a way that wasn't necessarily being dealt with in the flexibility training. So that is basically the first chapter, and I'm going to do the second chapter as well. I hope everyone's enjoying this and following along. At this point, I'm just going to take a small break and say, if anyone feels like it, if you could give me a review on your favorite podcasting apps, that'd be awesome. I'd really appreciate that. Other than that, let's get going. So, how to stretch in the second chapter. The right stretching method will let you have great flexibility even without a warm-up. We can't argue with that. This is the kind of thing, is like, if you train correctly and you assess correctly and you apply the right intervention, your flexibility, you should be able to express. We have two things going on. We should be able to express our operating range of flexibility quite easily. It should just be there. There is ranges of motion. I know, like, if I want to get my foot to my back of my head and a back bend, I can just do it. I don't even need to warm up. Or maybe I might need to do a small warm up if I'm particularly tired or dehydrated. But it's just there. It's just boom. Whereas other things, it just takes longer. And this is the kind of thing, is that if you have certain range of motion your body is biased or very good at or very well trained, they should just be there. And slowly the body will change to the point where it just is flexible. It doesn't need anything else. It just has this range of motion available at all times because it become normal. That takes a while. This is one of the other ones. A lack of this ability indicates either that the stretching method you use is incorrect or you're chronically fatigued, or both. The chronic fatigue is one of these things that is huge in the fitness industry. People train too much. They're constantly training. They do too much and they don't recover well. Recovery is a skill. This is why we generally, when I deload, I just want people to take time off a lot of the time. And yes, you could argue there's benefits to doing a bit, but in a lot of time, it's just like, take the time off, do nothing, let your body fully recover, give it a load of food, ice cream, whatever, then retest, and then see how your flexibility is. That is key, I think, or I believe, to really seeing your true potential and letting it come out. Otherwise, the fatigue will mask the fitness and mask the range of motion and mask all your skills. And, you know, this is it. And the other one, the wrong choice of training methods. Choosing methods that develop other athletic abilities and skills, but that interfere with development of flexibility as well as total athletic development. This is one of these things that, like, you get this a lot, where someone will want to throw a very intense stretching routine on top of a very intense training schedule. And it is a problem where it's like, oh, I'm going to do, I don't know, just like a full middle split routine, full front split routine, but I'm also going to do 20 rep squats and a host of other things. When we're doing a strength training program, we're also trying to raise the level of strength and flexibility. It has to be done in tandem. It can't just be like, I'm following Smolov and I'm also going to do my splits. It can be done, but something has to give. Whereas if you want to make optimal or very quick progress, you have to begin to look at the total volume, total training volume, both weekly, monthly, and over a longer period of time, to see what the recovery capacities of the person is and to see how you can fine tune things. And that is, it's a big problem nowadays. I think people train too much a lot of the time, or train maybe not too much. They train beyond their recovery capacities. So just bear that in mind. If your flexibility is improving in the way you want, you're probably training too much and not recovering well enough. And once again, what do we know? Consistency. So he talks a bit about early morning stretching, and I will just read this. It's this idea that it's kind of, when your body gets up in the morning, it is in an almost state of flux with the nervous system, where you can use this possibly to imprint the nervous system. We're like, oh, if I get up first thing in the morning, and the demand I place on the body is I'm going to move through my full range of motion, and I'm going to swing my arms with a bit of speed. Maybe not super fast, but I'm still going to expect it. we've got to get into expect and express range of motion, because it goes like this is what is expected of the organism in its day-to-day activities, in its survival activities, let's call them what they are. So this is one of the ones, and in this book, what we'll get to in the second half of this review, is the Thomas Kurz routine. But one of the things he does recommend is doing leg lifts and arm swings. Why it's not leg swings and arm swings are okay, who knows? But the idea is that you are lifting with a kind of semi-dynamic manner, the arms through a very loose range of motion, or the legs as well, the arm legs and the leg legs through a range of motion. So you are getting up and you're doing probably 30 in each direction. So you do front, side, back with the legs and do the planes with the arms. This can be beneficial. It's also one of the things I use in the head to toe routine, is that you'll get up and you'll immediately do some pulsing. You'll take a piss, do a small bit of wiggling around, boom, do it. It works very well, but it's not needed. Eventually, as your flexibility begins to rise and rise and rise, your operating range, which is the range that your activities take place, will be able to be performed without any excess of muscular tension. And then your upper ranges will still have muscular tension, the Morgan effect, if we go back to earlier ones. But at the same time, the range in which you might want to kick someone in the head. Why does it always come back to kicking people in the head? It's like, hi, someone mugs me. Hold on, let me warm up so I can kick you in the head. Hi, someone mugs me. Let me warm up so I can kick you in the knee. Or kick you really fucking hard in the balls. Like, it's always that thing. It's always like kick someone in the head. You know, I've been in, I'm not going to say a lot of street fights, but I've been in some. I can remember two street fights where someone started trying to kick me in the head. One guy threw a giant, I don't even know, like, if you know what a skanger is or a chav, we have them in Dublin. And one of them threw this spinning, jumping axe kick at my head. And it was like unreal. It was like set up good. He'd like kind of jabbed and had me on the back foot. And then I seen the kick coming a mile away. I grabbed his leg and took him to the ground and stunned his balls. It's, you're gambling with thing if you start kicking above waist height. I don't care what anyone says. Like, keep your kicks low. And don't worry, you know, save the flexibility for dropping into splits at the bus stop to impress the old ladies. But kicking people in the head, wait till they're on the ground, then stamp on it. Maybe is it probably a better safety aspect. Anyway, enough violence. But it is, yeah, it's always this kind of thing. There's a bit of machismo to this that I don't like, where it's like, yeah, I gotta not warm up my flexibility. Why? Because I'm kicking them in the head. All you have to do is look in an MMA ring and look at how much they miss with kicks. Look at how much they miss with jabs and crosses and hooks. Generally not a lot once they're in range. Look at how much kicks miss, and that will give you a hint. If the best in the world are missing their kicks, you don't really stand the chance, and you're probably better off just like elbowing them in the face. Anyway, enough said. Here's an interesting one, and you maybe have seen this. And I've done this myself, actually. In New York City, I've seen people sitting on heisters in order to warm up before a kickboxing workout. You know, there's been time when I was cycling to school and I was so cold because it was like minus whatever outside that I'd sit on a radiator to warm up my legs before I'd even start my warm-up. I wouldn't say it is a warm-up, and I don't believe that warming is getting warm in that sense. Obviously, you need to internally generate the heat, but I wouldn't knock it completely. If it was like midsummer in New York and super hot and thing, well then, yes, they're wrong. If they're coming in from -4, let's give them a bit of leeway on that comment, actually. Doing static stretches before workout that consists of dynamic actions is counterproductive. I would actually argue that they can... Static stretching is if you go in and go, oh, something is tight in a way that I do not expect it to be tight because it's holding muscular tension and it's interfering with me doing my technique in an otherwise safe and controlled manner. Doing a small amount of static stretching and then following it up with dynamic activity will not hinder your workout. It's kind of some of the stuff that the latest research has shown and it's been backed up. Sets lasting almost up to 60 seconds can still be useful. Also, doing short contractions are also useful in this thing. So, you know, you could do your joint rotations, do your cardiovascular activity or more dynamic motion, closed chain motion, picking up in speed, do your open chain motions, go, oh, my XYZ feels tight, stretch your XYZ a bit, return to your dynamic motion. This is where you can begin to tailor your warm-ups yourself. And once you follow a kind of logical progression to warming up, you can perform static stretches for the muscles you're going to be using, the muscle groups and the pattern you will use in your workout, and the reduction is going to be very negligible. So just bear that in mind. If you follow my advice to the letter and the rest of your athletic training is run rationally, you should be able to display your current level of flexibility within a month without any warm-up. Whose athletic training is run rationally? But yeah, I totally agree with that. If you start applying, this is the kind of thing, depends on what you're training. If you have this inherent level of flexibility that is kind of in the body based on your training history and everything else, you should be able to get that out quite easy. Getting beyond that range of motion, this is where things are. It's like, oh, when we see a lot of fast results, like I got chair split in 1 month thing. This person could probably already do the splits. It just would warm them up much more and do skipping, whatever, and this stretch, that stretch, 14 different stretches with the hamstrings, all this shit. And then you can just get them there quicker. This is one of the things with isometric stretching, is like if the organism has the ability to display it, this is why it works so well for side splits, by the way, has the ability to display it, then the isometrics get it out quicker. If the organism does not have the ability to display it, then it will take time. Do not feel bad if it takes time. This is once again to my 18-month rule. You need to get those muscle architecture changes that are kind of neglected and not mentioned in this, and then you'll be able to display it. And then your capacity will raise, and then your expression of that total capacity can be raised quite quickly. I think that's also like, if we go back to our talking about using full range of motion training versus stretching methodologies, I think this is one of the things, is that people had the ability to do these things in the organism, and the strength training got it out just as much as well as past training. What would be interesting to see is like when we reach the, where does the cutoff point happen and we need to actually do specific flexibility methods and the full range of motion training doesn't work as well. Something to bear in mind. You'll notice that a lot with calves. People who want to get flexible in calf, they've been in calf raises for a very long time, their calves still aren't that flexible. Something to think about. Or squatting. People who've been squatting for a long time and they have, the depth is definitely improved, but they're still not all the way down. This is the crux of it. This is one of the things. The flexibility of an athlete is sufficiently developed when the maximal reach of motion, notice it's reach of motion, not range of motion, somewhat exceeds the reach required in competition. This is definitely one of those things that it's how much flexibility you need enough to perform your stuff without tension. And having a bit beyond that gives you that, the boundary conditions for, this is what I would call the operating range. So your operation range has to be able to occur without tension or without restriction from the muscles that are undergoing elongation. So bear that in mind. It's like, how much do we need? Maybe you don't all need splits, but if your sport involves a little bit of bendy, it probably does. The other thing about this book is it is geared towards athletes. It is geared towards this. It does never really talks about aesthetics and how much flexibility you need to, you know, how much do you need to generate the right aesthetic you want? How much do you need to express a certain embodiment? This kind of thing is where things get even more nebulous and harder to define. This is the thing. It's harder to find, harder to measure, but it's very easy to see. And that is kind of the crux of it. It's like, oh, I am flexible, but I can get all these range of motion, but the tension is inhibitory and stops the expression of the self, the will, the aesthetic, the mood through the body. And, you know, this is, it stops the subtext communication that is happening through the body because the tension inhibits it or stops it moving. So there is this as well to bear in mind, that it is a sporting text and not a general lifestyle text. So yeah, there's one interesting thing that he has, these exercises involve kicking the hands, and centers in your brain that regulate coordination, rapid movements, know about the hand. So he's kicking the hand. They know where it is and that it can stop the kick. So the leg does not have to be slowed down gradually to prevent overstretching. So you're talking about the coordination between agonist and antagonist and other stuff. The interesting thing is you, once again, find this 1,000 years ago in Kung Fu with stretch kicking to the hands and slap kicks, where you're like literally trying to kick and smash through your hands and it's operating as a break. This is one of the reasons for these kind of stretch kicks, that they teach the body to what I would call abandon force, where you putting force into something, it's coming out the body and it's not stopping, it's going out and transferring. This is where you get a lot of your penetration in your strikes. And this kind of thing of like, you see this kind of, if people are familiar with Fajin, and you fudge in and the person is shaking. They haven't abandoned the force. It's a stylistic thing and they're doing it wrong. And this kind of, it's vibrating in the body, whereas a proper fudge in just kind of goes completely out. It's like a whip. And everything's, it's another topic for another topic. But this idea of using something to hit against is part of it. And those smooth changes in the elastin collagen and the periosteal fascia is another part of it, a very big part of it. So just a bit more context. You should be careful in choosing your stretches. However, because too much flexibility can be detrimental to your sport performance, for example, in jumping, an excessively loose trunk at the moment of takeoff causes a scattering of force. Is that really a flexibility comment, or is it just a comment more on just be tight or don't like wobble around or learn good jumping technique or bracing technique? Yeah. There's one here I actually wanted to get to on this is, Olympic weightlifters need to shorten the muscles surrounding the hips and knee joints for proper execution of the lifts. I'm going to say the Chinese will argue with that. I'd say Klokov would argue with that. I'd say a lot of weightlifters who are very fucking flexible would argue with that statement. Why do we need to shorten them? Do we need to shorten all of them? Do we need which muscles of the knee? We need to be specific. And generally, weightlifters, as a rough rule of thumb, are generally more flexible than most other athletes. Not every single case, and obviously it's a joint by joint basis, but generally on the hips, particularly if they're squatting ass to grass, like, unless he's talking about powerlifting weightlifting, which is a different kind of weightlifting, it's not quite, and I assume he's talking about Olympic weightlifting. So I disagree strongly with this statement. And you also see it like in some of the saves, when you see the true flexibility of a weightlifter coming out, when you see the saves they do, when it's like, oh, I didn't go to my optimal depth, but then suddenly my legs are dropped all the way into internal rotation, or some weird duck walk happens, or the person goes all the way through with the hips past their heels and like kind of not just down but forwards. We see this a lot, and obviously they're dealing with big weights and possibly it's not the best thing, but you know, yeah, it's definitely one of those things that it's a controversial statement there. Here is the one I want to finish on for today. The use of partners in stretching. The practice of using partners in stretching is a waste of time and is dangerous. The helpers neither stretching nor resting. The dangers of using a partner stretching is obvious. And the partner does not feel what you feel. He or she can easily stretch you a bit further than you would like. I would argue, and one of the things that obviously, as I mentioned, Kit Lachlan and stretch therapy, which is basically a holistic partner-based system more so than any other thing. I would argue that partner stretching, when properly applied, is the most faster and faster than the methods applied in stretching scientific of getting flexible. Partner facilitated stretching, I have an article on this, so it gives an overview of some of the kind of context to it, is probably faster, more precise. It depends on the skill of the partner and the skill of the practitioner. We have to bear that in mind. But we do have to think of, if these methods are so successful, then it's not just, this is the thing, it's the bias of the system is coming from old school gymnastics, old school acrobatics, and the coach just kind of rams you into position. I had some muscles, this is the kind of thing, I had some of my muscles badly torn because of this type of coaching, yet I still say partner stretching is some of the most effective. So it is this kind of thing that accidents happen, but skilled partners will get you there faster. And just because they're not resting, it's like, well, you could, in a properly done partner stretching situation, you could get away with doing one session a month and get gains and get continual gains and not have to do the other stuff other than sort of dynamic other stuff. And that kind of thing also facilitates the psychological emergence, the reduce of the apprehension reflex, the reduction of overall muscle tonus. That can be done very quick in these situations. And you get a lot of bang for your buck. It just comes down to the skill of the partner and the skill, the willingness to experiment and explore these methods. So there's a bit about injury prevention and children and flexibility. I'm not going to talk about that. Injury prevention, I'll do a different one, and children I'm going to do a whole podcast on. So that is kind of just a bit of commentary on the first couple of chapters of the third edition of Stretching Scientifically. I have the fourth edition on a PDF that I'm going to compare and just make sure it's the same. But So basically what it comes down to with Thomas Kurz is the method, and we'll talk about the methodologies in the book next time work. We cannot dispute this, we use a lot of them. It is in some ways a kitchen sink approach that you have to do to get maximum results. You have to do a bit of everything. We could argue maybe not. But if you had an assessment system that allowed you to assess and go, this is your needs analysis of the person, the organism, can we get it? These are other things. It doesn't really give an assessment system, and there's some other stuff about muscle, bone, archaeologies and archaeology, anatomy and geology and geology, oh my God, geometry that we need to discuss in the next one. But overall, this is kind of one of these classic texts that if you're into range of motion development, you need to have it in your library. It is available at stadion.com. The link will be in the description for the podcast. Get it. I also recommend buying Flexibility Express by Thomas Kurz. And he has got some, I don't know if they're in print anymore, but he had some old VHS that I could find on a library, of all places. Libraries do VHS over here. That also show stretching flexibility methods. I think they're on YouTube as well. They've been borrowed on YouTube. But like, at the end of the day, we owe a lot to Thomas Kurz on this thing. So I do recommend buying direct from him as much as you can. And it's very good to see him, who's obviously the master, and is obviously, he's a physical specimen. He's approaching 70 now and is probably more flexible than most people listening to this. He is in great shape. So it's always this idea of like, if someone is promoting a method that they use themselves, always going and still in fantastic shape at age 70, the method probably is pretty good for longevity, unlike a longevity coach who's 25. So we just bear that in mind. As I said, get this book. You need it in your library. You need to read it. You need to study it. And, there is research in it that you need to check up and assess properly because some of it is outdated. But all in all, it gets 8 thumbs up. And other than that, or we will be back next week. Other than that, have I got anything else to say? I've got nothing else to say. Have a good week.